All righty. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I'd like to welcome all of you sitting in your kitchen having grilled cheese and tomato soup on this snow day with your kids. We're going to talk to Andrea Haines, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation, in just a couple of minutes. A little bit later in the program, Elise Glink will be along. You know Elise. Well, she wrote a book in 1997. So how many years ago is that? 30 years ago? 25 years ago? I don't know. Anyway, it was about 100 questions for every first-time home buyer. Well, she got a new edition of it just coming out. I want to ask her, because I think she told me all 100 questions are new, something like that. It's changed that much. So we'll talk to Elise Glink, and also about a plan to forgive $1.4 trillion in student debt in order to boost the economy. Don't hold your breath. We'll start with Andrea Haines from the Chicago Tribune. Andrea, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
So you're coming from a remote location. Are you hunkered down? Are you under blankets before a fire? What's exactly going on here?
I am. I'm in a secret location with my pug, watching the snow fall outside, although I feel like there's not quite as much as we planned for, but it's still coming down.
Yeah, I think there will be. It's just going to keep, it's going to take a while to get here. They said all along it was going to be a long snow event. They had said that the trial, the court case between Waymo and Uber was going to be a long event, too. I was talking to Ian Schur from CNET just about it yesterday, and then I was told reporters were slack-jawed when they were told today there was a settlement. What's that about?
Yeah, so that got settled quickly, didn't it? I think there was an expectation that that would drag on a little bit longer. This is a trade secret battle between Waymo, which is basically Google, and Uber over some trade secrets.
Right, so there was an engineer who left Waymo, and the company was acquired by Uber, something to that effect. And then it was the driverless cars and the technology behind that. So they were fighting it out in court, and they thought it was going to be a long fight. Turns out now they've settled, so Waymo ends up getting some equity in Uber, which is interesting to me because the two are going to continue to compete against each other when it comes to driverless cars, but now the Google's Waymo will own part of Uber.
Yeah, so the deal's valued at around $245 million, and it does mean that these companies that have kind of been bitter enemies for months or a year will now be, in a way, working together because one will have a stake in the other.
It's kind of weird. Okay, a big week for Grubhub this week, right? They had a court case in California, too, but they signed a great deal with the company that owns Taco Bell and KFC. It's Yum Foods, right? Yum Foods.
Yes, exactly, which owns Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut. So that deal was one of two big pieces of good news for Grubhub this week, and its stock was up quite a bit, from around $67 on Monday to around $84 today.
Yeah, it's down a bit today. It's down a little over 8%. So it had a nice ride yesterday but dropped a bit today. So what does this deal mean for Grubhub? Will they now be delivering Taco Bells to everyone in the country, or is it just regional, or how's it going to work, do you know?
Yeah, so they haven't released super specifics on how they're rolling it out. They are starting in markets that actually don't include Chicago. Those are Indianapolis, Omaha, and Louisville, Kentucky, which is where Yum Brands is based. So people in those cities will be the first to be able to order Taco Bell and KFC delivery through Grubhub.
So we're going to still have to we'll have to show up to eat our chalupa?
Exactly. For a little bit longer. I mean, it certainly sounds like something they're planning to roll out nationwide in the near future.
I want to talk to you about another story I saw in Blue Sky this week, and it has to do with this. It's called Yonder, I guess, and it's a mechanism or a pocket. I'm not sure how to describe it. You do that for me. But it's a way to hide your cell phone or keep yourself from your cell phone in order to keep your mitts off, right?
Exactly. So we're all addicted to our smartphones, right? And everyone is noticing we can't go to a concert, we can't do anything without constantly being on our phones. So this company called Yonder, with no E, because, you know, a startup needs to have not quite as many vowels as you think needs to be there. So Yonder, they make a sort of like a little neoprene pouch that is sized for your smartphone. And what you do is it, say, a concert venue, if an artist doesn't want everybody to be on their cell phones, and that might be for copyright reasons, or it might be just because they want you to have the experience and not have everybody be distracted by their phones. It's kind of a pouch with a locking mechanism so that attendees are basically forced to put their phone in this thing, which gets locked with like a proprietary locking technology. So you can keep your phone with you, and it creates that sense of security. Look, right? Nobody wants to just like check their phone like you check your coat, right? So it gives you that security around your phone, but you're not able to use it through the course of the event.
It's a really interesting piece because it's the guy who came up with this, I don't know if he was a philosophy major or student, but he's sort of keen on philosophy, and he's tuned in to the impact that cell phones have had on our lives. He said that the smartphones, the development of smartphones, are sort of on the equivalent of when newspapers came into business or when we developed a phonetic alphabet. He said that it's transformed humankind that much, and he's just worried that it's going too far.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think you see even Silicon Valley executives, there are story after story about how they don't let their own kids use phones all that much, or they restrict technology around their family lives. I think, you know, people are just coming to terms with some of that. And one of the interesting things also about the Yonder is like they're using it in schools. So you can imagine settings where maybe we can still have our addiction 20 hours of the day, but for a few hours, if we're in school or at a concert, maybe it's good to not have constant access to that thing.
Is there been any results? I mean, how is it done when they've been used at schools? Any, like, do grades go up, things like that?
Yeah, I don't know how well they know that yet. I did read an interesting story by someone who tried it, like, for a concert type of situation. So people are just starting to kind of experiment with it and see how it impacts, like, how they experience an event.
All right, let's squeeze in one more here, the move toward gadgets for seniors, right? We're all getting old. The baby boomers now are getting older, and there's this worry that people are being isolated. Did I read in the story that they said isolation, senior isolation, is as dangerous to your health as 15 cigarettes a day?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, for seniors, you can imagine the many ways that, you know, snow days almost give us a facsimile of what it might be like to not get out of your house and not be able to run out and go do everything, and how, you know, kind of dependent you are on technology. And in that case, maybe the positive role it can play with keeping you connected to society or your family, and, you know, people being able to check in on you and help you, and all the positives that, you know, a smartphone can provide if you are a little bit more isolated.
And so is this going to be something therapeutic and beneficial, or is this going to be exploitative, where, you know, our big businesses are going to come up with these products that maybe won't be so helpful, but there's a lot of people who might be eager to buy them?
Yeah, I mean, I will jump on the answer both for that. I think there's always, you know, there's always good and bad. I think this piece is kind of interesting because it talks about some of the inventors of these things tend to be young,
right?
And they're having to come to terms with the different needs of older people. Like young people, they want devices to be as tiny as possible, and, you know, they want them to be, you know, just quiet, or things that if you're older, you might need the exact opposite, right? You might need a little more size to it. You might need a little more volume to it. Like some of the differences that young techies will have to think about when they're developing products for older adults.
I don't know about that. Andrea Haynes, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation. Great to talk to you. Have a good weekend.
You too, Steve. Safe travels.
Go get the shovel. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We'll talk to Elise Glink, maybe your first-time home buyer. She's got a new edition of her book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask, and she'll kick that around in the second half hour. But right now, I want to take a few minutes to talk to Jillian Berman, who is a writer at MarketWatch.com. Jillian's been on from time to time. Welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so every student out there, graduate, who's got student loans on their back, loves this idea of forgiving $1.4 trillion in student debt, right? I mean, who wouldn't want to have their debt waived? And here you write a story about how great that would be for the economy.
Yeah, so the story is based on a study which came out of the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College, which takes a look at sort of the hypothetical of what would happen if we canceled the full $1.4 trillion in student loans. And what they find is that while, of course, there would be a cost to the deficit, it would actually help to boost GDP and, you know, free up money in people's pockets that they could spend to boost the economy in other ways.
It's not insignificant money, right? I mean, they say that it could boost GDP annually by as much as $108 billion.
Yeah, per year. And that's, I mean, it makes sense, right, when you think about how many people have student loans, about 44 million. And for some, you know, the average debt is about 37,000, but some have a lot more than that. And, you know, if you think about, you know, a young family and they're paying more than $1,000 a month towards their student loans. They can't buy a house, car, things like that. So
a million,
you can see how that would happen.
1.5 million jobs a year as well if all of this money was pumped back into the economy. But you mentioned the deficit. I mean, someone is owed this $1.4 trillion. So that can't be an altogether good thing for them to see that money go away.
Yeah, so and for the bulk of it, the people that are owed the money are taxpayers, because most of student debt is owned by the federal government. But, you know, what they argue in this report anyway is that the boost to the economy would sort of, you know, compensate for that, you know, would balance that out. The other thing that some of the researchers noted to me, you know, and it depends on your sort of your political viewpoint on this, but the cost to the deficit of doing this is less than the recent tax cut. So, you know, we were thinking about different things that, you know, that might cost money and have benefits. You know, that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, no, and that's what we're talking about, economic stimulus. So how would this compare to that? Now, the difference is you could make the argument that everyone, and to some extent, or perhaps almost most, are benefiting from the tax cut, where this would be a little bit more isolated or targeted. You talked to Stephanie Kelton, who's a professor at Stony Brook, and she said something fascinating to me. I want you to explain it a little bit. She talks about these students who are buried in this debt right now as sort of being accidents of history, that it didn't used to be this way. It's probably not going to be this way in the future, but the people who happen to have been born at that time are just screwed.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's sort of the case from her perspective, right? So historically, we know that for decades, you could go to a public college, your public and state college, for, you know, maybe if not free, for a relatively affordable price. And also during that period, wage growth was better. So people had more money to spend on college, so they weren't relying on loans as much. But over the past several years, you know, wages have stagnated, college costs have skyrocketed, and so people are really relying on loans. And now we're seeing an interest. It's hard to say whether we're actually going to get back to a closer to free college,
right,
you know, situation, but we're seeing an interest in that. So she's saying the people who are saddled with the debt right now sort of are the unlucky in between.
And so how about this idea of actually moving toward forgiving the debt? Is there any real chance at that?
It's hard to say. You know, no, other than Jill Stein, no politicians have really embraced something like this fully. I mean, we'll see. The study just came out last week, so it's possible that it might inspire, inspire some people to take it up. But, you know, there is, people have concerns, right? Like you said, not everybody has student loans. So it is,
right,
it can be kind of a hard sell politically, right, to say that we're going to give certain people a break on this thing that not everyone has.
It sounds like, to me, a pretty good idea, but yeah, almost an impossible sell. I mean, I paid off student loans, so why should people who are holding them now not have to pay them off? Things like that. I guess the difference is my student loans were minuscule compared to what my kids are going to come out of school with in a year or two.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you can already see, you know, sort of the opposition to this type of thing right now. Policymakers are arguing about the best way to forgive student loan debt in cases of fraud. And that's even controversial, right, when the school sort of lied to the students and things like that. And some people don't even want to forgive that debt. So you can see how this would run into problems.
Jillian Berman, a reporter at MarketWatch.com. Great to talk to you again, Jillian. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN as we sit alongside a very snowy Michigan Avenue here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. It's a good weekend for a book. And hey, if you're going to read a book, on the phone line now is Elise Klink. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
So if you were recommending a book for this weekend, I don't know, is there a title you'd suggest?
Well, you could, if you really wanted to, pick up a copy of my new book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask, 4th edition. You could do that.
The 4th edition of this, and we've talked about it from time to time a little bit. I just got it in my hands earlier this week, a very handsome cover and a nice-looking book. But tell me about, because I think you told me that, is every question, each of the 100 questions, different this time around, or was it the answers that are different, or how did that change? You said, because it's been remarkable since the first edition.
Some of the questions have changed, and the organization of the questions has changed. The answers, almost all of the answers, are different than before. And part of the reason is that we now officially have a new cohort, the millennials, who have finally entered the world of home buying. And as of this year, actually it's as of 2017, they're now officially the largest group of people who buy homes, and they represent more than 50% of all people buying homes for the first time. And it's a sea change.
What is the youngest millennial, like 22, 23 years old?
Yeah, it depends on how you look at it, but around 22, 23, and the oldest is around 36, 37, again, depending on how you look at it. What's been really interesting, and we've talked about this a little bit over the years, is how the millennials have really time-shifted major milestones in life. And so they're buying houses now at age almost 34 as an average versus 26 when I first started writing about real estate.
So does that mean that their first home purchase is a different home? I mean, you know, at 36, I was prepared. I bought a very different home than I did at 26.
Well, it's interesting. Homes are a little bit different today than they were 25 or 30 years ago. They tend to be bigger. New homes that are built, which now would be 20 years old, 10, 15, 20 years old, on average were a lot bigger than they were maybe the houses that you and I bought. And like you, my first house was much smaller than the house I bought later on.
Right.
But so millennials, but they're colored by things like HGTV and Pinterest and House, you know, websites that showcase the most beautiful homes in the world, and they want their houses that they buy to look just like those, so, even from the get-go, and that's very different.
Well, does that mean then that the smaller houses that used to be starter houses are sort of going for want, that they're not being resold?
Well, they are being resold, except there's not very much in the market right now. And so one of the problems confronting millennials is we've got rising interest rates. Home prices have zoomed where incomes haven't changed much. And so they are having to look at those starter houses, even though they don't really want to.
All right. I want to ask you a few questions about that people might come up with. I'm sure you're covered in your book. One is how to negotiate when it comes to buying your house. I mean, what are the keys to doing that? For me, and then I'm going to ask you a question, then I'll answer it. But for me, anytime I was involved in a transaction, whether I was buying or selling, all I wanted was the initial offer. And once that came in, then in my world, it's like, okay, we've agreed to dance with each other. We're just going to now settle on the music, but we've partnered up, you know? So I would always invite that. I've never understood people who were sort of insulted by a low offer.
Yeah, sellers who are insulted don't really understand how the game is played, but for a buyer to negotiate, you really have to understand what the edge of your affordability is, because prices are moving up so fast that you can very easily go into what I call land of unaffordability without even meaning to do it. And so I want people to set that maximum price that they're willing to go to, and you start below that, but it's a good way for you to kind of get in. And then if the seller, for whatever reason, doesn't choose to respond to your reasonable first offer, then you know to move on, because you know you'll never get to where you need to be or below. And you don't want to make that mistake of overpaying, because trust me, and you know this better than anybody, once you move into a house, it's not like the expenses are over.
Right. And so what are the sorts of expenses when people are coming up with that high figure, the top figure? What sorts of things are they not considering? Are they overlooking?
Well, you generally will look at real estate taxes, and now with the Tax Reform Act, you have to be pretty careful about what you're able to deduct and not deduct, and if that's going to have an impact for you. And it may for some people. It may push home ownership off the edge for them, or they may have to look at different neighborhoods and lower-priced homes, because you only can deduct $10,000 total between SALT, the state and local taxes, and your real estate property taxes.
Do you know, I've talked so much about this, and I don't know this basic question. Is it the same level for married couples? I mean, does it double for married couples?
I believe it's per tax return.
Okay, that's what I didn't, you know, I'm working on my taxes, and I'm like, wait, this could be not as bad as I thought. But so it's per return, so that still is pretty bad.
Oh, it's really bad, and it talk about a marriage penalty.
Right, yeah.
But for people who are buying homes, you know, they don't think about that, and they need to. They need to really think about what the maintenance costs are. So we've got, like, the snowiest day we've had in years today, right, and this whole weekend. And there's costs to a snowblower or having somebody plow your driveway for you or salt that you're going to need to buy. And then in the spring, the repair for all of the, you know, the damage that you've done by plowing your snow or putting salt on your grass. And, you know, you've got to think about the, you know, mowing and all the other things that you want to do. And that's just the beginning part of it. You know, there's all kinds of maintenance and upkeep that a house needs in order to stay in good shape to keep the winter out.
That makes me think of home inspections. What's your guidance on home inspections? Because I think a lot of people become overly freaked out by the report they get from their inspector sometimes.
I think that having a professional home inspector, whether you're buying new construction or you're buying existing homes, is a must. I just think it's really important. Typically people, especially for some buyers, you don't know the mechanics of a house. You don't even know what the water shutoff looks like or where it is in a house. And so having somebody who's knowledgeable about these systems take you through, and you can follow along and take notes, you can videotape the person so that you have some sort of written record or videotaped record of what each thing is, allows you to get an insight into what sort of future problems you may have to contend with. And trust me, the last thing you want to do when a pipe bursts is spend a lot of time running around going, now, where was that shutoff valve?
But that's a mess. I also tell people, though, that when you're getting your home, when you're getting a prospective home inspected, that you have to remember you're paying a person to tell you every little thing that's wrong with that house, and that there might be important things that you really need to know, but you don't want to put too much weight on the very little things because he or she's going to tell you about all of them.
That's right. And the other thing you don't want to do is you don't want to hire a contractor to come and do the inspection, because a contractor, you never are sure whether they're just telling you like it is, right? Or right. They're trying to get business for themselves. Whereas with a professional home inspector, they don't do anything to fix up the house. And so ideally, you've got somebody who's done, you know, thousands of these over the years, who's just in it to tell you what's wrong, and then they take their fee and they move on. And if you need an additional heating contractor or you need some other sort of contractor to follow up, like for radon, you can get referrals and start pursuing those too.
You write in the book as well about buyer's remorse. Tell me a little bit about that, because that must be about the worst thing ever.
Yeah, there's nothing bad, worse actually, than you make an offer, it gets accepted, and then you think you've immediately overpaid for the house. Or you're like, oh, why did I do that? This one just came up and it's better for me. So I want to reassure millennials and all first-time buyers that feeling a little buyer's remorse is perfectly legitimate. And you're going to feel a little strange anyway, having made this huge financial commitment. The average price of a home in Chicago, existing home, is somewhere around $280,000 right now. And if you're buying a new home, you're going to agree to put up somewhere around $350,000. That's a significant amount of money, and it's a real commitment, and you're going to be nervous about it, and it's just going to be fine.
The name of the book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. Elise Glink is the author. Where do people find it, Elise?
You can go to Amazon. It's the one with the blue cover. It actually officially is published on Tuesday, so if you order it from Amazon today, they'll deliver it next week. Or you can go to my website and get more information there.
Actually, it's a very handsome cover. This is one of my favorite colors, this sort of slaty blue, or Confederate blue. Yeah. Fine choice.
Yeah, thank you. I had nothing to do with it, but folks at Penguin Random House did a nice job.
Our number of the week this week is 90,000. Former Buffalo Sabres owner Tom Golisano is so fed up with Canadian geese turning the lawn of his upstate New York summer home into their own personal toilet that he's refusing to pay the local village's taxes. It's $90,000 in his estate. Says he's tried using fishing line, repellent, even a wolf decoy to keep the birds from going, but nothing's worked. So he's not going to pay his taxes until the Finger Lakes town does something about it. The town says, that's not our job. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN 1252. All right, let's talk to, Front Row Phyllis is on a phone line. Phyllis, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm fine. You know, I saw a commercial or some sort of notice for the auto show's big black tie affair, I think is tonight, February 9th.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
Well, I worry about them. You know, I hope they can get a crowd and people show up, because this is just a rough night if you're doing something like that, or a theater or any sort of special event, I would imagine.
I think so. I think it's going to be a little hectic, but I think that as long as we take it a little slow, we're all going to be in our beautiful long gowns along with the men in their tuxedos. Tonight is, of course, the first look for charity event. And the car show kicks off officially tomorrow on Saturday and runs through February 19th over at McCormick Place. There's some great things this year. There's three test tracks, Jeep has one, Toyota, and Kia.
Which one are you going to use first?
I think I'm going on Jeep. How about you?
Okay. I'm more of a Kia person, I think. Did you say Kia?
Yeah, Kia and Toyota.
Okay.
And then what's really cool is Jaguar actually is introducing their first compact SUV. It's called the E-Pace. So that should be kind of cool to see.
What's it called, Phyllis?
E-Pace.
E-Pace, okay. That's a lot of cash to spend for a crossover, an SUV, don't you think? A Jaguar?
I think it's probably up there with the BMWs and the Porsche has one. So I think it's going to be probably at that level. I'll let you know because I might be able to. I'll just purchase one later on tonight.
Well, swing by, will you? Because the weather's fine. You can drive by here. There'd be no problem with that at all.
Exactly.
So there's that at McCormick Place. Oh, also, a couple of things going on at the Windy City Winery. And one is Natalie Merchant Wright is going to be there with her band.
So it is 10,000 Maniacs, and that is tonight and tomorrow evening. You know, 10,000 Maniacs are one of the most critically acclaimed bands performing over the past three decades. They actually kind of redefined college rock, and they were actually the first wave of alternative rock bands, which I didn't realize that, right?
It's funny you say that because I was in college when I think they were probably coming to the fore in the early 80s or mid-80s, and they're one of those bands who's got a name that doesn't match their music, because I remember clearly thinking, why would I want to listen to someone called 10,000 Maniacs? Really, but I love listening to them. So they're at the Windy City Winery. So you're going to go from the auto show to the Windy City Winery? Is that what you're going
to
do?
Yeah,
tonight?
To the city winery. Yeah. You know, I'm just going to be, hopping. I think I'm going to have my own private Uber tonight is what I really have to have.
And then you're going to check out the chocolate show there at the winery? Or what's that about?
Doesn't that sound wonderful? So it's on Valentine's Day. So on February 14th, it starts at 7 o'clock. And let's match chocolate and wine is like literally the perfect pairing. Right. I mean, it has my name written all over it. And there's going to be top pastry chefs there as well as wine connoisseurs. You'll get a chance to taste some of the exotic chocolate desserts and wild wines. So I say skip dinner and just head over for dessert.
I don't know. I'm not a big chocolate person. I don't think that's going to be
okay.
But I'm interested in the show Love Never Dies at the Cadillac Theater. What's that about?
Yeah, so this is actually, it runs February 14th through March 4th, and it is the sequel of Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, I didn't know. You're always introducing me to things I feel like I should know about. I didn't know this show existed.
But that's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. And you're going to love this. This is actually, it takes place 10 years after the disappearance, and the Phantom now has a new life. And he is living in Coney Island in New York, which is kind of funny to me to begin with.
Yeah.
And then Christina Day actually is, of course, one of the best sopranos, and she's on tour. And she happens to be going to Coney Island in New York to perform. And so you get a chance to see, there's everything from intrigue and obsession and romance, and you want to check this out.
To a roller coaster, I guess. Yeah, okay. So. Yep. Yep. Love Never Dies. What's it called again? Love Never Dies.
Love Never Dies.
Phantom of the Opera set at Coney Island.
Yeah. It should be great.
You're not even convinced. That just sounds that sounds a little too twisted. I don't know about this one.
I know, but it's actually, seriously, they're calling it the best of Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Wow.
Phantom of the Opera. We got to check it out.
I'm kind of embarrassed. I didn't know too much about that one. All right, Phyllis, where do people find more information about all of this?
Just go to frontrowphyllis.com.
All right. Yeah, I know you got a big night ahead of you, so be careful. Enjoy yourself, okay?
Thanks. You too. Have a safe weekend.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.